I'd like to start out today by introducing my esteemed colleague, Kim Cash. Kim is a partner at Ashland Partners and a CPA. Ashland Partners is one of the only firms in the country that provides the level of service and detail to be able to bring a firm into GIPS compliance. I first met Kim probably about 2 or 3 years ago when we brought her on as a consultant to help one of our investment advisors be able to advertise GIPS compliance or performance reporting, certainly. I should probably say going forward that the thoughts that I'm about to express as a speaker myself are my own and not those of Emeritas Investment Corp, the company for whom I work. As I mentioned, my name is Kim Paschal. I am the head of advisory compliance for Emeritas Investment Corp. I have a JD, and I'm working on my LLM in corporate securities from Georgetown. Today, we're going to talk to you a little bit about what you need to do, what steps, what pitfalls to avoid should you have an advisor that comes to you and says, you know, I'd really like to advertise performance. What do I need to do? So without further ado, I would like to turn over the mic to Kim Cash. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, I'm really excited that Kim invited me to come share what I know about GIPS. I know a lot about GIPS with people who do things that most of my clients don't do, because most of my clients are just the RIA side of the business, or that's who I'm really focused on. However, my goal today in this presentation is to share with you what I know that's relevant to what you do. So I will be struggling to do that, and I will encourage you to raise your hand if you have any questions as I'm talking about anything to keep this dialogue very interactive. I can definitely say that even in the last session, you know, one of the things you're looking for, I mean, there's probably several reasons why GIPS should be important to you, but if you're looking for value-added propositions in the RIA world, complying with GIPS is critical for them, for those advisors, if they are registering with consultants and filling out consultant questionnaires, because they are being asked, are you compliant with these standards? And is that compliance verified by an outside party? And if they want to grow their business, or if they're already $500 million in assets or larger, they're looking for public fund money, there's going to be a requirement, really, for them to comply with these standards. Even though they are technically voluntary standards, it's still very important to any RIA that is interested in growing their business in that community. So in order for you to have all kinds of opportunity to add value, and not only maybe grow and acquire other RIAs or IIRs, certainly to keep the ones that you do have. It's good to know what's going to be involved in being able to talk about GIPS, which is the Global Investment Performance Standards. And as it was mentioned earlier, it used to be known as the AIMR PPS. And back in the day when it was the AIMR PPS, I was afraid to go in and talk to broker-dealers about these standards because they would call me up because they had one rep that was just insistent on having this done. And I'd go and I'd sit at a table and they'd say, well, we've been tossing this around and we actually got 5 or 6 reps that really think that they would pay for this and this would be good for them. And so we'd do this project and it's a big deal and we'd go through it all. And no sooner than we would do that, they would take their GIPS compliant, back then AIMR PPS compliant track record, and they would leave with it, and they would go put out their own shingle. And that was, I think, what Philip was referring to earlier, that a lot of these reps that became RIAs, they came from the broker-dealer side. And so, I mean, that's one thing to keep in mind. a GIPS-compliant track record it's very portable. This was my performance and being able to have the books and records and have it all in one neat package that's strategy-based. Makes the manager very portable as well. So if your firm can offer GIPS compliance, I think, you know, you can certainly offer other value-added services that would keep those valuable reps with you, but that's just something to keep in mind. Okay, so these are ethical standards, and they're focusing primarily on calculating and presenting investment performance, but we're not going to talk about math today because I already promised. I will say this, most portfolio accounting systems that are focused on serving broker-dealers haven't had to think about composites. They've been thinking about client reporting. And so unless you're like in the RAP world, security APL is kind of the big gorilla in the RAP world in terms of portfolio accounting. And they also sell directly to RIAs, and so they have a lot of composite functionality built into their software. And there are others. I mean, I think Advent works, you know. And in those softwares, it's going to be pretty easy to go through a GIPS compliance project. If you have proprietary systems or you have systems that really haven't worked with composites and don't already invest in GIPS compliance and you're trying to do this on a spreadsheet, then I would say it's going to be a challenge. It's going to be a challenge for your IARs to maintain. And they may, you know, if you're bringing in an RA, they may already have some portfolio accounting system and they'll just keep what they have, but that's going to be a cost to them, and it's going to make your value add maybe not as much as it would be if, in fact, you had an accounting system that you knew was also going to help them in the calculation functionality. And so the key word there is composites. Just, you know, look into your portfolio accounting functionality, and can it really do composites well with accounts moving in and out and by strategy focus and things like that. So, and we'll talk a little bit more. Yes?
Just to refresh everyone's memory, can you give us a definition or just a better understanding? Composite is such an important word in this talk.
It is.
Can we talk a little bit about that?
Yes, good. It's really the heart of the standards. And actually, my next slide, before there was GIPS or AMER, there was representative account performance. And with representative account performance, obviously, managers could pick their best performing account and would. Why wouldn't you? So the whole idea behind these standards is let's take all of your accounts that are managed in the same strategy and we'll group them. And then we have a composite. And here's your growth composite, and here's your income-focused composite, and here's your conservative, and whatever your strategies are going to be. Sounds easy enough, except for, as all of you know, especially if you work with retail, people come in with their own legacy securities, and because of low-cost basis, you can't sell them, or there's some sentimental attachment, or they say, we don't want to own any tobacco stocks because, you know, they have relatives that, you know, whatever their own restrictions are that they bring there. So grouping all of your accounts into strategy-based groups can be very challenging if your managers have been working with very individualized strategies. Now, like Kurian was up here earlier, and he talked about how model-based they are. You know, here's their models. This is what they do. You give them money, you're going in one of those. And if they have four or if they have eight different strategies, then you've got four composites or eight composites. That's really easy to figure out. But if your managers are really giving very individualized management, then it can be a little difficult. The cool thing about the standards is they give the managers a lot of leeway if they want to make very broadly defined composites and say, hey, we've got an equity, and we've got a fixed, and we've got a balanced. They can do that, and then they can decide at what point are accounts really not discretionary. And this is another term that I'm going to get to I think, the next slide. Some of the jargon in the broker-dealer world is a little bit different. And discretion is really probably the single most difficult word that we get a lot of confused signals on. In your world, discretion means trading discretion. That is not the same thing as discretion in the GIPS standards. There are pages talking about what is all discretionary fee-paying accounts in a composite. You may have a discretionary contract. You may have discretionary trading. But if that client comes in with a lot of legacy stocks that you can't sell, according to GIPS, you have every right to say, we're not putting that in our composite because the performance of that account is not really going to be reflective of our manager. So you get to define discretion and you get to apply it consistently. Now, if the stocks that they happen to hold really go through the roof and the performance is fabulous, you can't just stick them in now. You have to, it's all very consistently applied. And so account membership becomes a big part of account membership in these composites becomes a very big part of compliance, and that's something that we then would come in and test to make sure that membership in that composite group is consistent. So composites really are the heart and the vehicle with which the track record is delivered and then also presented in the marketing materials.
So like a real life experience that I had when I was first bringing my first advisor to be able to advertise performance, his first question out of the gate was, you know, I think I have this great model. But a big part of the reason there's no downside, and this was about 4 years ago before the drop, is because I have municipal bonds. Is there any way that I can just sort of carve out the municipal bond performance and just focus on the equities? This was obviously before the crash. So my answer to him, according to Kim, would have been...
Well,
not
yes
no,
and no.
No in the equity. He
right.
had one full of equities
right.
and bonds mixed.
Right.
And you can't then just say, no, we'll just focus on the stocks that performed well and pretend that part of your composite wasn't comprised of bonds.
No, absolutely. He would have to show his entire record. Now, could he also say, but I want to compete for institutional money, and they don't want to see balanced equity and fixed income in what institutions want to know. They want to hire equity managers and fixed managers, so I want to just show them my equity. Can he also have a composite where he's carved that out? And the answer is yes. So the answer was no and yes. You have to show something that's representative of what you're doing. Can you splice and dice your composites so that you can present to the marketplace what the marketplace is asking for? Yes, you can. And there's all kinds of rules around that, and I don't want to try to teach you all of those rules. I don't know that that would be as relevant for you today. Certainly could in future sessions. I could talk about KIPP's compliance for hours and hours and hours, but I don't think y'all would stay that long. So I'm just trying to hit the high points. And so basically we have composites so that managers can't just cherry pick their best accounts. They can't just show, you know, the last 2 years, if they've done well in the last 2 years because they had some kind of contrarian something going on or betting against the market. They have to show, you know, if they have 10 years of performance, you have to see how they've done the last 10 years. And maybe they underperformed until the crash, and now they look really good. But, you know, they've got to show the full 10-year track record. So there's no selective time periods. And then also something else we run into a lot with FAs especially, no model performance can be shown in lieu of actual. Because a lot of times FAs, when they first start getting their own stuff, it's maybe mutual funds. Maybe they have, you know, these 7 or 8 mutual funds that they blend this way for their growth, and they blend it a little more conservatively and do different things with funds like that. And they have models, but they don't actually have, obviously, reporting where it's easy for them to generate actual account performance that's being run to these models. So if you're going to claim compliance with GIPS, you have to go to the work of actually then grouping the actual dollars that you're investing in these strategies. You can't just use your model performance. Because with cash flows and timing and the nature of if you only maybe buy a certain amount or sell a certain amount on this day and other accounts get executed on different days, the performance can be very different among the accounts. And in an ideal world, it's not. In an ideal world, once you group these by strategy, all the accounts in the composites should perform fairly similarly. In the real world, you find out that they actually don't. So, final point here is survivorship bias, and that's simply that the problem, again, even with representative accounts, if you're not in a GIPS world and you just say, well, we don't want to cherry pick, we'll pick, you know, our 10 largest accounts that we're managing in this strategy and we'll group them together and we'll show that. Well, that's fine, but that's your 10 largest accounts that you have now. You're not showing us several other large accounts that you lost 2 years ago that maybe would have performed less, so that sort of thing. So you get to capture a lot with this concept of composites. The problem, however, is you need a portfolio accounting system that can have accounts that maybe have to go out for a certain period. If a client comes and says, I'm uneasy in this market, don't do anything for a while, well, you take them out of the composite. But then if they say, okay, you know, or maybe they're waiting to pay their taxes, or maybe they're waiting to buy a house, or who knows, but you might have accounts go in and out of a discretionary status, and so you need an accounting system that can do that. Or what often happens with a lot of our financial advisors, if the broker-dealer can't, you know, supply a portfolio accounting system that can really have some composite functionality, then they end up taking the accounting information at the account level from the broker-dealer, and then they're doing their composites on spreadsheets. And that's fine. They can do that, too, if it's 50 accounts or 100 accounts, and when it gets to be 400 accounts and they're managing it on a spreadsheet, it gets to be a bit cumbersome. And obviously in wrap platforms, y'all call them separately managed account platforms, then, you know, you get into tens of thousands of accounts and you don't want to be doing that on a spreadsheet. But I think most people at that point are using Security APL or something. So here's some advantages. When you go through all the work of creating these composites, it makes you more comparable then, theoretically, to other growth equity managers, because now you've grouped everything that you're doing in this style, and you kick accounts out if for some reason the client comes in with some things that don't really fit with the manager style. They get kicked out. So what you're really getting is something that's representative of the manager. And all the same time periods, he can't just show an annualized return that's through his best quarter, his or her best quarter. It's got to be annual calendar year so you can really compare. And it really is the best practice on the RIA side of the business. So in that world, even the SEC will oftentimes, when they do an exam, if they're examining an RIA and they don't comply with the standards, they're not going to hold them to a lot of those disclosure rules and those kinds of things. But if the manager is obviously cherry-picking because they're changing the representative account from period to period, then they will say, in a write-up, they'll say, that's not industry best practice, and you can't do that, even though there's no explicit you can't do that. That's going to be misleading. So it really has become a de facto industry standard, even though it's technically voluntary. But you've got to, even though the SEC likes it, consultants consider it, you need to know that the SEC will also then test to make sure managers are in compliance with it. So if you have FAs or IARs or RIAs that are putting in their marketing materials that they're in compliance with these standards, then somebody needs to be making sure that they really are, because then that's created a liability for you as well, because the SEC would consider it misleading to put that claim on materials if they weren't actually in compliance. So some key concepts. Compliance on a firm-wide basis. This throws a lot of broker-dealers, because they're used to referring to these people as reps or FAs or whatever you call them. Well, in the GIPS world, you have to be compliant on a firm-wide basis. So maybe your whole broker-dealer is going to take this project on for all of your FAs, but maybe not. Maybe you were really just thinking, the only ones that are really, you have discretionary contracts, a lot of them are more commission-based. I mean, you were just going to do some of them, not all of them. So what usually ends up happening is it's individualized for the FAs, but they have to become a firm according to GIPS. It doesn't have to be a legal firm, but in their marketing presentation, it's usually going to have the FA's name. It might have the broker-dealer's name in the name of the firm, but your legal department has to approve some kind of a firm name that can say, this is the GIPS-compliant entity.
So like many of our investment advisor partners or representatives will have a DBA name.
Exactly.
So something like that would be appropriate.
DBA, absolutely. And it usually ends up being a DBA. So you've got to define the firm, and it's usually by the FA. And so once you've done that, then because all of your discretionary, at least for GIPS purposes, have to be in a composite, then you have to kind of go through the list of all the accounts that FA has and determine which ones are discretionary and which ones have limitations. And that can be quite a process depending on how long the history is, how many different kinds of strategies, and again, are they going to come up with three really broad composites, or if they've done a lot of individualization, they may come up with 10 or 15 different composites. And if they come up with 10 or 15 different composites, somebody's got to check and make sure that each account really meets that definition for each of those composites and those kinds of things and maintain that. But again, the firm has a lot of flexibility in whether they want to do it broadly or narrowly, if they want three composites or 15, how they define discretion. And so I'm going to get back to Kim's point when she said, can her FA or her IAR carve out accounts, parts of accounts that they want to not include in performance? The answer is yes and no. For example, if a client comes to the FA with some legacy assets that they don't want them to sell, you have options. You could say, well, this isn't going to be representative of the manager. We're just going to say it's not discretionary, and we're going to exclude it from everything. That's one approach, and it's simple, but it might exclude most of your assets then. Another approach would be to say, we're just going to call those assets non-discretionary or unsupervised, if your accounting system might even have that functionality. So we'll have the discretionary assets within that one account that we'll include in the performance record, and we'll include that in the composite assets, and these other assets will be below the line. And that's allowed, and I think in the retail world that's a really important functionality. So if you're shopping portfolio accounting systems that will actually really make it easy to comply with GIPS for your FAs, look into that and see if they have functionality around unsupervised assets when they're working with composites, so they can kind of splice and dice these a little bit.
Is it your experience that some of the more major custody firms, your Pershing, your National Financials, your Danes, do they provide that, or would one have to go to another vendor? That type of accounting, or is that something that maybe just an investment advisor rep would get his or herself?
I think obviously, I think all the portfolio accounting software folks would love to work for the bigger entity. But I think by and large, they typically, it's the IR or the RA that's coming in that already has their own portfolio center because of the big Schwab, the connection with Schwab. And, so it just kind of depends. Did you have a comment there?
I have a question.
Oh, a question?
Related to what you asked.
Okay.
Reporting, which we don't do now, but if we were to implement that, and that number is different than the one coming out for Pershing, I would worry about, maybe a customer complaint or, why is this different, kind of questions, things like that.
That's a great question, and a lot of times, client reporting, the clients in the composite will have different numbers than the composite. And that does happen. And if, in fact, they are provided. See, GIPS was really about preparing composite performance presentation to prospective clients. So typically, you'd come up with this number, and you're not necessarily going to send it to your existing clients. You can, and it's actually recommended. Maybe once a year, you send clients the performance of the composite that they're in. But that's just going to create a lot of, hey, why did we underperform? Unless they overperformed. But not everybody's going to overperform the composite. Maybe half of them will underperform.
Our experience, what happens is that our investment advisor representative gets, in this particular, I'm thinking of one in particular, he gets his numbers from our custodian. In our particular case, we clear through three firms. In this particular case, it's National Financial. So what happens is he gets his original numbers that feed the composite data from the custodian. And so then he would, and that would feed into this accounting system and create that report. So in this particular case, there won't be any difference because there's a central data feed. That, however, is it going to be on my side when I discuss a little bit about some of the challenges. That to me was the greatest challenge, trying to sync up and get National Financial to work with our own home office technology back office Caesar system to then hook up to his office to be able to create the composite. That's like the number one challenge. But that is the way the information flows, and that's why they're in this particular type of setup, there won't be a dual accounting system or some type of battle of the final numbers.
Yeah, and I guess that's a different issue even than if you have two different account level returns versus a different account level and a composite level.
So if it's built for prospective customers, I guess I'll be even more worried because if my true customer sees that it's supposed to be 87% return and they got 4%,
So we can talk a little bit about that. Obviously, when you group these, one of the required disclosures for GIPS compliance is this dispersion, which is standard deviation, so I don't want to talk too much about it because that's math. But basically, you've got to come up with, Oh, good. Then you can come up here and explain what dispersion is. It's just a standard deviation number. You're going to give them kind of like two-thirds of the composite falls within one deviation. So, for example, if your composite return is 10%, then, and you have a dispersion of 1, then that means that two-thirds of the composite either got 9% or 11% or somewhere in between. Two-thirds of the composite is within one standard deviation of that 10% return. That's not so bad. If you're marketing 10% and all the accounts in there are somewhere between 9 and 11, you know, the people getting 11 are going to be happy. The people getting 9 are going to call you and say, well, what's up? But I mean, it's really not that bad. But you're absolutely right. If you have some outliers in that composite that are getting something completely different, then that's an issue for you to look at and say, maybe they don't belong in this composite.
And that's part of the agreement that we set out, part of what we looked at when we first set out to do this, is to make sure that we hired someone that would be able to lead us through doing an audit to be able to check for that type of issue.
So, you've got your composites built, and now you get to prepare some presentation materials. One of the required disclosures is you actually have to state the definition of the firm. So it has to be either, it can be an investment firm, but it can also be a subsidiary or a division or a person's name, DBA, or a broker's name with DB, doing businesses as the broker-dealer's name. But you've got to come up with some wording because that's going to be on absolutely everything that you put out there as a GIPS-compliant performance record. Okay. And I have some sample definitions. You know what? And I have business cards. So what I will do, I mean, if this is something that you're really interested in, if you want to give me your business card, I can send folks just some sample definitions that other existing broker-dealer representatives have used when they've had to define and hold themselves out as a firm of their own. So I could do that for you and get back to you with that. When you're considering this, you want it to be rational and fair. What you don't want, and you know, I think Kim, although I try to keep these examples anonymous, but what you don't want is if somebody has one product that they're really excited about and they say, well, we've got to get this GIPS compliant because we want to put it in the consultant databases. We think this has some, the public firms might want it, or, I mean, big corporations might really be interested in this product, and so they want this to be GIPS compliant. Your definition of firm really can't be just about one product. It really needs to be broader than that. It needs to define everything that the investment decision makers at the firm, and if that's one person and his team, his or her team, that's fine, but it can't just be product-based.
Part of what we did to make sure that the boundaries are very clear is we made sure that this particular investment advisor is an independent investment advisor and not a corporate IR.
Yeah. Yeah, and also you get a lot of pushback on this point. That's the only reason why. I mean, it's such a practical, easy, I could say it and move on. But the problem is the portfolio manager really wants to push this one product out the door. And when they have to, they might have 20 accounts invested in this product and it would be quick and they just want to do that. And instead they have to look at all 2,000 of their accounts and most of them are doing all kinds of things that they they don't know what kind of composite to put them in. So it can make a GIPS project very much more time consuming when you have to look at everything you're doing and not just the one focused product.
Do you define everything you're doing as only those accounts coded for discretion or just advisory based accounts in general?
Yes. You have an option there, and we have clients that do it both ways, where they really just want to define their firm as the discretionary business that they have and leave off commission based and that sort of thing. And then we have other firms that will define everything that they're doing, but they only obviously have to put into composites the ones that are actually discretionary, so the advisory base don't actually end up in a performance composite. Either way is fine. And again, as I mentioned earlier, in the GIPS world, it has to do with the definition is really can you implement your strategy? And if there's client restrictions keeping you from doing that. And another thing is size. You know, you may be able to implement your strategy for your client, and you're both plugging along having a good time, and then the next thing you know, they start opening up accounts for their children or for their mother-in-law. And those accounts may be much smaller, and you can't really invest them in the breadth of securities that you need, but you're not going to say, no, I'm not going to take your $20,000 accounts for your children. You're going to take them, but you're not necessarily going to put them in a composite because you're going to do something a little bit different with that amount of money than you would with $250,000. And so you can make those, you can draw lines around size, around tax. You know, if you have clients that have, you know, they come to you for tax loss selling and other things or put holds on their account from January to April. I'm always paying my taxes at the very last. October 15th, but most people pay by April 15th, right? So January to April, yes.
Do you define a restriction as systematic withdrawals or contributions?
Yes, if it's systematic, so that you have to obviously keep more liquidity in that account, then that's going to have a different performance number, and it's not because of your management style, it's because of your client's restriction. So that would be a bona fide reason to keep them out. And again, these are all legitimate, but you have to also be careful, because if you go through all your accounts, and when you're all finished, you only have 1% of your firm assets that's actually in a composite, then that's going to raise red flags as well, because obviously, not only even raising red flags, but also, I mean, most people do this because they want to get into consultant databases, and so having a certain amount of assets in that strategy is important. So you don't want to define them so narrowly that your composites are too small to really capture the fact that you've been in business a long time, you have a lot of assets under management, and you want that to be reflected in your composites. So you have to kind of, it's a trade-off. There's a sample definition of discretion. Did I talk for an hour?
No.
Oh, that's how long okay. I thought I had 15 minutes left. I'm like, I couldn't have talked that long, you guys. Okay. Accounts are considered discretionary unless a material client-imposed restriction prohibits the investment manager from applying the designated investment strategy of the composite in which the account resides. I've talked about this 3 or 4 times now. When you leave here, y'all are all going to know definition of discretion for GIPS is different than it is in the broker-dealer world. Okay, so there's actually, when I think of what you need to do to comply with the GIPS standards, there's 3 things, really. One of them is you have to develop policies and procedures. And we have a template that kind of goes through and asks all the questions you need to think about. The first one being, how are you going to define your firm? And how are you going to define your list of composites? But it covers a lot more things than that. And those things are such as, when new accounts come in, are you going to put them into the composite immediately? Or at the beginning of the next month? And I would say for a domestic large cap equity manager, that makes sense. But I would say if that manager is dealing in micro cap securities, or if they're dealing in other strategies, that might be difficult to invest in. They're not as liquid, and they might want to take their time. Dollar cost averaging was big 10 years ago. It went away, and now it's back because the markets have been so turbulent. If managers are only going to invest a little bit of the client's cash for a 6-month period or a 12-month period, then it's going to take a long time before that account's really going to look like what the composite's supposed to be doing. So you need to think about those things, and how long does the manager usually take to get an account representative and looking like the strategy? And you should set up a policy then so you can be consistent. And what you don't want to have is, I mean, if it's not in writing and the market tanks and you've got accounts sitting all in cash, boy, you'll just put them all in. Because and we've had clients where, a client makes a big deposit, it's a big client, and the market tanks, but their composite, it just looks so good. But that's because it was sitting all in cash. And it's like, okay, that's not really representative of what your strategy did. You got lucky that time. But so you have to have policies around how you're going to treat cash flows and all kinds of different things that you want to put in these policies. So that's one leg of this 3-legged process that you go through. And you talk about them all ahead of time, so then you know you're not kind of, you're not doing this on a performance-based decision where you say, well, we'll define the composite this way and see how performance looks, and then we'll go back and try it this way and this way. So you kind of just come up ideologically. We're sitting down. We're coming up with policies and procedures that make sense. Do we care about a minimum account size, or can we invest a $50,000 account the same way as we can invest a $250,000 account? And if we can, we don't need a minimum account size for the composite. So you kind of come up with what you think makes sense. That doesn't mean you can't go back and change them, because you can, but the idea is you want to just make sure you've thought about these sorts of things, composite-specific policies and some firm policies. And then basically, you've got to pull together all your documentation, and if you've got 10 years of performance for thousands of accounts, that can be a big deal. So that's actually a huge deal. And if your portfolio accounting system can't splice and dice then and actually build the composites, if you're doing it on a spreadsheet, that's a really big deal. So, ideally, you'd have an accounting system where you could say, okay, we're now going to create this composite, and you would start assigning accounts to that, and it would take care of connecting that with the performance history so that you didn't have to go in and rekey that in, because otherwise that would be, you know, obviously it's a big project. You want the right tools. As mentioned, you know, we talked about composites are the heart of these standards. This is how you do it. You take all of your accounts as the firm that you've defined. You create separate groups. You see about things like discretion and if there's anything that you can think of. And a lot of times, you know, you mentioned what if an account has a return that's way out there. You may have thought about everything and then you forgot, oh, yeah, we have an account that has this weird thing going on. So you can obviously, once you get your composite numbers, go back and look at them if they don't make sense. We had clients that put a composite together and realized they had one account in there that was paying a fee that was totally different than all the other accounts in the composite. And they're actually thinking about rebating that client's fee because they were a long-term client paying three times what everybody else in the composite was, and it was skewing their composite performance for net performance. So they're probably going to give the client their fees back. But they didn't even realize that was going on until they put them all together. Okay, and then you've got your composites. These are just some other details about composites because they are such an important. I mean, this is really how you're going to be marketing yourself now, by composite. They need to be strategy-based or investment objectives or something like that. It's not going to be based on, not typically based on this manager or this office or this. I mean, it really needs to be a meaningful strategy then that the marketplace can compare to other managers offering that same strategy. And then I already talked about including and terminating portfolios have to have a process that's consistent for including and excluding. And then what I maybe didn't mention is you can't really move them from composite to composite to prevent cherry picking again, but also unless there's something from the client that would cause a reason for it to get moved from one or the other. So the portfolio manager can't say, we're going to start. Here, I'll give you a practical example. when the tech bubble happened, and I'm going to jump, I've had some similar questions in more recent years, but I'll jump back to the tech bubble. I had a manager call me up and say, you know, Kim, here's the deal. And it was a beautiful, beautiful argument that he made. He said, it's like your kids. You know, you see them every day. You don't realize they're actually changing. But you take that family photo once a year, and you look at it, and you go, wow, they really changed from year to year to year. We have these clients, and they all fit in this composite, we thought, but some of them, you know, some of them just kept getting a little more and a little more technology and a little more technology, and they were changing a little more, and he's calling me after the tech bubbles burst, and he's saying, and we just think we need to move these that were really heavily weighted in technology. They really were different, and we just didn't notice it until the market tanked. And now we would like to remove them historically from our composite because they really were different. And I have to say, you know what, I'm sorry. That wasn't client-directed. Maybe you were trying to be a little more aggressive because clients were saying, hey, everybody else, all my friends are getting better performance. Why aren't I? And so you started doing that. But really, you made that decision, and you kept them in that composite. And if you really want to define the composite so that it can't have more than X percentage of technology, you can on a go-forward basis. But you can't do it now that the market's tanked and historically change it. But you can on a go-forward. So, you know, those kinds of issues. All right.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yeah, sure.
So we run five models ranging from conservative to aggressive growth. Mm-hmm. And clients can move in between those models
yes.
whenever they want. Generally, we get a change of investment objective for
right.
it.
Right.
Sometimes we just get an email from a representative who was talking to that client
yes.
saying, you know, they're nervous, they run aggressive growth, move to income. At least like
if yes.
not to totally liquidate, which is fine. But the documentation of that?
That's enough. That is enough. And in a situation like that, as somebody who will come in to verify compliance, I would just simply look at the date it happened. I'd look at the trades. I'd look at, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Then nobody's trying to play
so
with
it's
it.
It's reasonable to see clients shifting.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of
absolutely. Depending on what the market does, clients have very different reactions and risk tolerances. Yeah.
A value stock versus a growth
yeah.
stock.
It's true.
How do you make sure that, you know, still, you know, portfolios the same across the board?
Well, I think that's what where the consultants get to do it. They get to add a little value, and there will be some conversations consultants will have with you. You may name your composite a value composite, but we had a very large national client that did that, and they had, you know, Apple in there or something, and they were calling it a value stock, and it was at one time, no doubt, but at some point it's not anymore, you know, and you have to go, okay. But their sell bias wasn't, I mean, you know, whatever. So, I mean, that's where a consultant would probably look at your numbers and say, you're really not value. You're really something else based on our what we're going to, you know, and we'll market you that way or whatever. But I mean, it's a good question. And obviously we want to make these numbers as comparable as we can. If you aren't kind of in the herd, I think that was terminology that somebody used today talking about fees. We want to make sure we're in the herd. Kind of the same thing here. If you're calling yourself a value manager, you kind of want to be in the herd. And if you're doing things that aren't value, then that's going to help you sometimes and hurt you sometimes. And compliance-wise, it could really hurt you if the SEC felt like you were misleading people. So you kind of want to just. But there are differences, and we all know it. So if you're just reasonably disagreeing on something, and at some point you kind of know when you're on the edge. And not in the herd anymore. But it's a good question. There's going to be inconsistencies from firm to firm. And sometimes managers are going to do better or worse, depending on what their little unique philosophy is. That's going to make their strategy look better in some markets and worse in others. Yes?
Well, I guess I was asking from those retail firms out there, like myself, mm-hmm. where if you were to, we don't do it yet, but we're thinking of letting them do this type of mm-hmm. One of my reps is going to call it a value stock, and another one of my reps is going to call it. As a firm, though, we have to make a decision. It's this kind of stock. Is that what you're saying?
Well, now that's interesting. No, that is a very interesting question. If you want to approach this, and depending on the size of your firm, you may approach this as a GIPS compliant single unit kind of thing, so that all your managers running value are going to be included. That is not what I would say is typical. In a broker-dealer arrangement, each FA is their own firm.
Right.
And they're doing business as, or whatever. So, I mean, they're their own firm, and their value composite will maybe have their name on it. This will be John Jones' value composite, and this will be Amy Foster's value composite. And so that's, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's why it was so important to first define the firm.
Yep.
It's like defining your universe.
Yeah.
Now, probably you don't want to have discrepancy too much between one advisor and the other, only because then that will be just differentiating from the herd in general. But
there's not much time at all to speak, and I want you to have time to listen to, you know, Kim's experiences, because she's gone through this before. All of my other slides, there's six more on here, and they're really just kind of giving you an example of what an advertisement would look like, and I think you're going to have access to these electronically. But you know, really, again, this is something, if you want to come up afterwards, I can give you my card or you can give me yours, and I could give you samples of advertising guidelines and what you can and can't say. The actual GIPS compliant presentation, it's a full page of, you know, you've got to show 10 years of performance for the composite and a benchmark and dispersion, and you've got to tell people how many accounts are in that and what the assets are and what the firm assets are, and that's all got to be showed for all 10 years. And then you've got all kinds of qualitative disclosure requirements. And in the advertising guidelines, it's not quite as much as in a one-on-one presentation. Here's some samples of things that have to be included just to give you a picture. It's a little less, but it's still, you know, it's extensive. And so just to underscore that this is a liability for you, if you have FAs that are claiming GIPS compliance, they have to follow the presentation part of this compliance piece as well. So, yes.
99.9% of the clients that we deal with in our retail would have no idea GIPS from
right, right.
Swips.
Yep.
Only that's more institutional
right.
type of advertising, so
mm-hmm.
they can compare an apple to an apple,
yep.
would it not be? Versus when you have 400, 500, 600 different advisors, all doing everything different, you would never be able to do that on a quote unquote broker dealer level.
No, not it's not common at all. Some people try to take it on. We've had some very large wirehouses try to take it on at that level. And really what it's going to be driven by is if your FAs really want to grow their business and they actually want to start knocking on doors or maybe fill out consultant questionnaires, even just to get, you know, smaller institutional business, if they see that as something they could do, they're going to drive it because it's the marketplace. Although there are benefits. Don't get me wrong. There's definitely benefits to going through this exercise. It tightens up how the portfolios manage money, and they start treating their clients maybe a little more equally. We also do work for some wirehouses where we're not—they're not claiming compliance, but we're actually checking to make sure are they following their investment policy statement. Because when you start grouping these by strategy according to investment policy statement, it's a little tighter than if you've got 400 accounts and they're all kind of individualized. How do you know they're managing them to their investment policy statement or not? So there are other benefits, but I'm going to turn it over to Kim.
Great, thank you very much.
To follow up a little bit on your question, the way that I've seen it in my firm is that I've been asked on two different levels. The head of my investment committee, I work for a dual BDRA that's an insurance agency affiliated. So we have our own proprietary wrap programs, and then we have corporate IRs, we have independent RIAs. So where I've seen a request to get this type of verification is the head of my investment committee that calls the shots for our own package product would love to be able to say he skips compliant, because then maybe more of our reps would be inclined to put their assets there instead of managing them on their own. Or he's even discussed maybe shopping this out and farming this out to other of our competitors as a package product. So that's one differentiator that is where we've seen interest. And then the other one is simply at the DBA, independent RIA level, where they just, in today's tight market, they want something else to be able to differentiate themselves. Some clients are starting, retail clients are starting to get wind of this. It's getting a little bit of momentum. If anything, it'll probably just position our advisors as being a kind of at the start of the gate, so that when people become more sophisticated and when they start learning more about this, they'll already be well positioned to be able to kind of be leaders in that thought field.
Oh, could I just insert, because you mentioned wrap, that a lot of broker-dealers require it for wrap program participants, for RIAs. That's just for due diligence, not because clients are going to care, but for their own due diligence.
Yeah, absolutely. So I just wanted to, kind of go over my experience, what happened 2 years ago when an investment advisor, a very large and very important investment advisor to our firm, came to us and said, we want to advertise performance. I think I'm a great portfolio manager. I want to advertise performance, and I want to be able to get the credit. And, by the way, I'd also like it eventually if Morningstar picked me up and kind of featured me as a product. What are we going to do? So first I panicked. Then I said, no, absolutely not, in my head. And then I kind of just said, the intellectual curiosity kind of got part of me, and I just said, well, maybe this is something that we're ready to do, we're poised to do. We took a look around. He had already looked and did some research on consultants. I don't think we would have done it if we had to do this all on our own, but we ended up hiring Ashlyn to be our consultants, and from there I can tell you a little bit about what my experience was and what, if I had to do it all over again, if someone were to give me a map work, what that map would have looked like kind of in hindsight being 2020. The first thing may seem kind of obvious, but you may not realize how important it is until you go through this. Consider the source. Consider the advisor with whom you're going to maybe be launching this if you haven't done this already. Very, very important, quality advisor, not only a lot of assets. You want to make sure that your advisor is excellent. You know how, I think, Derek, if any of you were in the former sessions, we were talking about the 80-20 rule. So 80% of our advisors are not on board with compliance, are not on board with technology, and are not on board with operations. And by the way, not on board is defined as doesn't excel at. I'm not trying to say that they're not compliant, but could be better at. So you definitely want to make sure that if you're getting out of the gate, that you have a rep who is excellent with technology, with operations, and has a good feel and appreciation for compliance, because you're going to need a lot of cooperation on their part. And if you have someone who can't hand in a switch form on time, doesn't know how to open up their email, obviously we're already starting out with a number of problems. It can be very, very challenging from a data management perspective, so you definitely want to make sure that you consider your representative and make sure that they're in the top 20% when it comes to those three areas: technology, compliance, and operations.
You have that left, would he not be able to create world peace?
Thank you. That's excellent. No, they you know, I wrote away to the Chicago Sun-Times, and they did say these advisors do exist, so I believe them. Thank you. Timely remark. So we kind of have already talked about what GIPS compliance is. Why would our firm choose GIPS? We talked about that a little bit. And again, somebody had mentioned before, it's really just sort of bragging rights, and that's pretty much it. It's sort of bragging rights. It provides a little bit of assurance, and it provides maybe a little bit more sort of cachet, and it also provides the opportunity to shore up different areas of compliance where maybe when they weren't trying to advertise performance, they weren't quite maybe ticking and tying and crossing their T's and dotting their I's. So that's something that definitely is sort of a cachet with regard to GIPS and GIPS compliance. I talked a little bit about how important systems are. We talked a little bit earlier about the data management. The most difficult thing for me when we were doing this was to identify someone at our clearing firm that would be able to help be a sort of a partner in this endeavor. So make sure I could identify someone at the clearing firm who understood how we needed the data to flow, where we needed it to go, what we needed it to look like. So I would deputize and make sure that before you promise your advisor that he or she can do this, that you've identified someone at your data source. So if you're self-clearing, that's fine. But if you have a clearing firm, you want to make sure you identify someone who can say, okay, we can turn on the switches, we can make sure that the data is there, and we can make sure that it's in a language that your home office system can then work with. The next thing is then you have to deputize someone in your operations who also knows what's going on and who also understands how to get the data feeds in, how to maybe create the reports at that level, or how to turn around and feed the data to the end source, to the IAR. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? Any success stories or horror stories or challenges that you've seen in that sort of process about feeding the data?
Well, I've seen it all. obviously it can be, if it's an integrated system, it can be very straightforward. And if you're rekeying everything in an Excel spreadsheet, the nightmare there is, well, then it can't really be iterative. It can always be iterative, but if you're going to key everything in and then change your mind and say, actually, we'd like to tweak the composite definition to do this or that, and depending on how many accounts and the history, it's
really huge to be able to get an automatic feed and not to have to do this manually, and that's why it's very important that you get your custodian and your ops team on board, and to there is a way to have an electronic feed into the composite, and if you don't do that, you're really looking at a nightmare. Luckily enough, we cleared through a large enough firm that was able to provide that type of packaged data. I think we did our own. We created our own spreadsheet.
It's actually they're basically letting the IAR take the data that they provide and then they're working with it in a composite. Mm-hmm. But fortunately, the data that's getting into the composite is pretty automated, and then they can do the final touches. They've got to be asset weighted based on beginning market value and those kinds of things. And they're just doing that in a spreadsheet.
Wasn't Walbrick building a composite methodology inside of their feeds from Pershing, National, et cetera?
I'm not. I wouldn't doubt it, considering that would lend itself, that would be very parallel to the other things that Allbridge is offering. I wouldn't doubt it. I can't see why they wouldn't, but that's the first I've heard of it. Think about budget. I can't really say what the consulting fee is, but the first thing that you want to think about is who's going to pay it. Are you going to ask your IAR for ours is an independent RIA, are you going to ask him to shoulder it? At the same time, our name is on all of his materials, so we're also sort of
being associated with that, you know, performance advertising cachet. So should we shoulder part of it? That was something that I highly recommend. The next step after identifying your key people is what I used was Kim's consulting agreement. I took Kim's consulting agreement because she sort of highlighted what all the relevant issues would be, issues that would come up. I copied that into Word document, and I used that to be a checklist for all the things that I made sure that we had in writing the BDRA with the independent advisor. So who's going to be paying the fees? Who's going to be in charge of making sure the data gets into the Excel spreadsheet? Is our ops going to be in charge of it? Is their area going to be in charge of it? Who's going to be responsible for developing the policies and procedures? Earlier, Kim said, make sure that you have policies and procedures. Who's going to actually be responsible for writing that? These were all issues that we didn't really know or anticipate were going to come up until we actually got into the thick of things. And what I can do, I can't provide you with our own agreement or my own checklist, but I have one that is available that is a little bit more neutral. And if you come up at the end when you give me your evaluation forms, you give me your card, I'd be happy to email that to you. So essentially what this is a quasi-contract between a BDRA and a rep, and a quasi-checklist of all the different things that you want to make sure that you get in writing and that you consider before you promise to launch this or before you do launch it. So that's something that I can provide to you. I didn't want to put it on the website because it has a hint of proprietary feel to it, although I did make sure that it was neutral, so that's something that I would just prefer to distribute on a smaller basis. I didn't want people Googling it. Regulatory and legal concerns. So obviously one thing that you do want to do, even if you have an independent RIA and your kind of rule is that you don't review their advertising, in this particular case, because of the more sensitive nature and because the SEC does take anything that would be misleading very, very seriously, I would offer your services to review their advertising to make sure that what the way that they advertise and looking at the advertising materials is compliant. That's probably your number one area of risk, I would say, is in the advertising. What I didn't expect and what I eventually saw is that our advisor was featured in an article in Morningstar. So I'm very, very happy that we had all of our ducks in a row. We did everything as perfectly as we possibly could. We went overboard and were very, very conservative, made sure everything was perfect because, you know, it ended up being featured in a, I don't know, international, if not national, if not international, article, and his product really took off. So probably the number one risk is that some regulator somewhere sees this and kind of looks around and says, I've never really heard of this, and maybe looks a little bit further into it, or a competitor in his town may get a little bit jealous about the attention that he's receiving and may look into that. So you probably want to make sure that you do an audit at least once a year to make sure that that data flow is being properly put into that spreadsheet, that spreadsheet, if it's advertised, is advertised accurately. Financial considerations. Again, it was some costs, some startup costs, certainly, to get the consulting in. It's ongoing costs to make sure that the consulting is continuously done, to make sure that the composites are continuously accurate. So that certainly is some cost. And certainly there's labor. There's going to be some labor cost on your BDRIA op side, most likely. As well as, of course, the RIA. Legal is going to be involved. Compliance is going to be heavily involved. Advertising review is going to be heavily involved. Maybe licensing. So these are all things that you're going to want to remember. We always forget about the soft dollar costs. You know, how much is this actually going to cost in time? But I would say that as a compliance officer, I'm an attorney and a compliance officer. I wasn't acting as an attorney, but I provided those services pretty much de facto. And I would say that I spent, just for this one advisor, I would say probably 80 hours on this all told over the course of about 4 months.
I would say that if you added probably a second or third, it would go a lot faster, right? Because it's that learning curve for the first time, or not?
Yes, I think that if you added a second or third, also this was the first one. Also, we're an insurance-affiliated RIA, BD, much more conservative, had to get looked at by a number of layers of legal and compliance aside from me. So, do you have any idea if you, when you go in, what do you tell people normally the BD, the home office people will spend on this? It's really probably hard for you to say because you're really more with just...
I'm really focused on the GIPS compliant defined firm, which is ultimately the RIA side, so how much time the others spend on it. Mm-hmm. But I will say if your technology is already in place to load into composites, then that's going to make it, And if you've already kind of drawn up who's going to pay for it and all of those considerations, once you do that once,
right,
then it's kind of done.
Well, the 80 hours that I mentioned includes looking at the contract, drawing it up, specializing it to our specific needs, building the checklist,
right,
you know,
right,
communicating all that. Yeah. So all told, for us, it was about 80 hours.
Yeah.
No. And you know, it's funny. That's a great question. Kim and I were actually talking about this. She told me, she's like, I just want to let you know. And I said, you know what, Kim? This probably allowed us to keep our advisor.
Right.
Our advisor was about to leave. And I actually had to go out there in person. We had dinner, you know, and you know, the whole thing. And he thought I was coming to give him the bad news and was ready to walk. And I was very happy to be able to give him the good news. And he is pleased as punch. We have a number of other advisors that are very excited about the opportunity. They're kind of getting their ducks in a row. And no, because, you know, in this day and age, the reason they're affiliated with us, they could be out on their own. It's very simple. It takes 2 seconds to write up an ADV and some policies and procedures, a code of ethics. The reason he's with us is because he still wants to be able to take advantage of the BD side, because he's not just IA. He also has plenty of commissioned clients. He wants to be able to take advantage of our insurance products. So, no, I think I was just about to say, you know, a few slides down, why else would you do this? Better recruiting capability. We have seen a dramatic improvement in our recruiting numbers because we can say, listen, if you have the goods, if you have the ability, if you have the drive, we can offer you this model where you're able to advertise performance. So definitely better recruiting capability, increased AUM, the dollars that aren't at his independent RIA, if he gets a client in, and some of the dollars make sense there, some of the dollars make sense in insurance, some of the dollars make sense, maybe his daughter or his wife. On the commission side, we're looking at increased AUM. It's been worth the time. Yes. No, we hire former SEC staff to come and do our annual 20647 review. And they looked at this, and they did have some questions. They looked at what did our process for review look like? Do we audit it? Are we checking the numbers? We were able to show that to them, and they won't actually come out and say it's good, but they didn't have any objections to it. Kind of talked a little bit already about the importance of data review and data provision. I think I've hammered it home pretty well. And also, I think we discussed a little bit about how important disclosure is. Also, what I can provide to you are I put together a list of common disclosures that your marketing pieces are going to look a bit lawyerly, unfortunately, but it'll kind of keep everybody nice and safe and happy. And I've put together a list of some standardized legal jargon, which I've taken from, you know, I looked at maybe 20 or 30 of the larger firms that are doing this and some of the smaller firms, and I looked at everyone's disclosure, and I kind of siphoned them all down to, I think, about a two-page document of commonly found disclosure language. So, again, if you're interested, that's something that I can send you as well. These are some things that I go to, kind of my cheat sheets that I go to when I look to see what I might have to do to enhance our investment advisors' marketing pieces. Again, something that you do want to mention, I'm glad that you asked that question. You definitely want to have follow-up on this in your annual review. Make sure that it's part of your annual review. If you hire an outside consultant or if you do it yourself, make sure that this is definitely part of something that you show sampling and testing on, because I feel very strongly that it's extremely likely, just as you pointed out, that the SEC will be extremely anxious and interested in exploring how we're going about advertising these performance results. And I think that leaves us some time for some further question and answers, and maybe a little bit of time for Kim to make some of their comments.
Yes.
How many years of performance history do you have before you can start reporting?
You can start reporting as soon as you have a performance period. If you have a month or a quarter and you want to claim compliance, you can do that. If you have 10 years of performance, you have to show 10 years. You can't just do the last year in compliance and start there. You have to.
So if that's 10 years of performance where you can correctly line people up into a compliance.
go-forward basis, you could drop off and only show the last 10 years. But they want to see 10 years of performance if you have it. And if you've only got 2 or 3 years, then you've only got to do 2 or 3 years. And that's okay, too.
Well, if you have model performance for, say, the last 5 years, you're using Albridge or whatever, you can't get the product, you can't get the system. And now you want to start with what's an older system. Can you start with now we can actually report kids? Because there's no way to go back and get 70 kids.
It's a great question.
The GIPS,
standards actually, if you're new to claiming compliance, they only require a minimum of 5 years, and then you can build up to 10. But you would probably have to wait 5 years before you could claim GIPS compliance. They're a little bit more lenient than the AMR PPS, which said you have to do all 10 right at first. They'll let you start with 5. But they wouldn't, unless you could make a case that the strategy really just began when you started to have the technology to manage composites, that before you were doing commission-based things and you didn't really have a set strategy, and it was really with your decision to focus on a strategy and get this performance system is really the inception of the strategy. It's okay to have been managing money for 10 years if you have a strategy, if you just started managing discretionary money. I mean, maybe that helps a little bit and gives you a little fudge room, but it's probably not going to let you say that it all happened today. It probably has been happening for a year or two anyway. So I don't know if there's absolutely no way you can get that history or if it's just hard to get that history.
I think if I remember, well, two things. I wonder, a question I have, but I think that the regulators have commented or GIPS has commented that there is some leeway for if information is technologically hard to get or to reproduce. Is that jogging your memory a little bit? I believe that some of what I might have in some of the handouts discusses a little bit of flexibility. If you can make a case that the information is technologically difficult to reproduce, there is a little bit of flexibility that they have there. But I'm not sure how much, so we can look into that for you. But the second question is, I wonder if you might be able to do a hypothetical. Would you maybe be able to figure out a way to maybe put a hypothetical in place that mirrored what you actually did to show? I wonder if you'd be able to do something like that.
You have the hypothetical already. You can't claim GIPS compliance with
the
hypothetical.
Right.
So, and if you've been managing actual dollars to that hypothetical, then that's the performance you have to show, and you have to show at least the last 5 years if you've done it. The hard-to-get stuff, they did allow some room back in the wrapped world when it was growing, the early, 2001, 2002, lots of money going into wrap, and not a lot of data flowing between the sponsors and the RIAs, and the RIAs are going, how are we going to comply? So they gave them some leeway until 2006. And they said, all right, we're going to say if you don't have all your records in a row prior to 2006, that's fine. But starting 2006, you better make sure you're getting the data from the sponsors so that you can put these. And they're either getting the data now or they're shadowing it on their own systems or whatever it is that they did to solve that problem. But I think that's really the only area where you have leeway. I don't think there's much fudge room there. I wish there was. I'd tell you, it might get me.
We've been running portfolios since 2002 or performance.
Yeah.
Grade.
Yeah.
Dealt with Albridge.
Yeah.
The issue, the problem with their performance after fees is it's after our management fees and then it's after the advisor's fees.
Yep.
It's net-net.
Yep.
Some advisor might charge 25 basis points and other advisor might charge 1% because our program is a wrap program.
And actually, that's okay because net-net is important in a wrap program because you're selling to prospective wrap clients and they're going to pay that and the SEC kind of takes a mutual fund mentality. You want
to
show both, right?
I can't get to that.
Well, yeah, that's tricky. You don't have to show both. You could, if you really wanted to play claim GIPS compliance now, you could show your history net-net and beginning with your new portfolio accounting capabilities on a go-forward basis, you could show both. I mean, we could sit down and figure out a way. I know we could, even if it was taking Albridge performance and working with a spreadsheet to do some things, but it wouldn't be really easy. And you can't start now. Bottom line.
Does it make sense to set some sort of threshold
Kim question. Gips wasn't going to tell you they have to have 20 accounts or any history, but certainly if you're going to take on that.
But when you start the performance, like once we say, okay, now you can call it a model, or do you have to go back to the origination of those 20 accounts?
I see what you're saying.
Because we kind of put in that compliance hurdle, mm-hmm. but now learning of this detail, you know, it might not be able, you may have to be forced to go back to start.
How did you handle that with this advisor?
You know, I think that he had been doing the same thing for long enough that he had the history. It wasn't an issue. Yeah. He had sort of been running it as if it were his own mutual fund and if it were his own wrap. So he had already had, I think, 5 years of consistent models going through. I mean, the only question, as I remember, you know, that I recalled that I mentioned earlier was that he just didn't want, in that model that he had built, he didn't want to show what was going on with the bonds. But he had already had that, so we didn't really have to deal with trying to figure. He already knew he had a set of clients that had already been in these products for a five-year period, so we didn't really have to go back and try and define what that composite was.
And it's not always that easy, but I think in most cases you can rely on the manager's representation. So, like, similar, you say you started in 2002, you had the models, you've been managing to them, you kind of know when you started it. And the manager's going to kind of know when this strategy started. And then the data should back that up. And that's where an outside third party. And the few slides that I didn't get to, I only skipped over three of them, were, you know, what is verification? And that's basically, you know, your FAs could claim Gips compliance without having a consultant or without getting somebody to come in and make sure that accounts really are all in appropriate composites. But that's what a verification would do. And so if the manager says, this is when it all started, you know, we can look at the data. Does that play out, basically?
You had a question?
Okay. You talked about your definition of discretion under Gips, mm-hmm. the ability to kind of pick and choose when it's appropriate. Does the date start when you start doing discretion under the normal, what we consider discretion? The ability to, you know, have a contract that says I can pick and choose at will, or what if you were have a non-discretionary yeah. account where you just recommend?
Right. You know what, we have given conflicting advice on this, and I would say the industry's moved on that, because I always felt like if you can have discretionary accounts that are non-discretionary, you can have non-discretionary accounts that are de facto discretionary if the client always says yes to all of your ideas. And I think the industry's moved. Back in 94, 95, that was okay. I think now they want to start with a discretionary contract and just be a little more conservative there. Yeah. And then you've got the paper trail. Good input. Yes, good input. Good paper trail.
I have a question. It's more for the one here. We happened to purchase a TAMP a couple of years ago. Now I'm having some of the larger broker dealers we deal with ask for Gips numbers for just third party asset managers. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, as broker dealers, are you all requiring that now?
We ask about it. So what we've been doing is, as I've been reviewing advertising, if our third-party money managers want our investment advisors to distribute their product-specific advertising and they advertise performance, I might look at who they are and just kind of say, you know, are you Gips compliant? Do you at least try to manage to a Gips compliant standard? And then usually what ends up happening is, say, the larger ones like your Morningstars or something like that, if they don't do it, I may not require it because there's some deep pockets there. If it's a much smaller firm, much smaller product, I don't think they've got deep pockets and they're insisting on advertising, I may not approve our IRs distributing their literature and distributing their performance numbers.
Don't have Gips compliant numbers. I mean, we deal with probably 70 of them, and I don't.
because some of them will say, you know, when I talk to them, they say, Kim, listen, we manage to GIPS compliance standards, but we don't feel comfortable and confident either because we don't want to do the verification or whatever, so we're letting you know that we're getting there as close as possible, we just don't feel confident actually saying it. They don't want to take on the legal liability. We actually have to wrap it up. It's about that time, so I'm very, very sorry to end this. But this has been a great group, and I really appreciate all your participation. Please give me your business cards and your evaluations if you're interested in receiving that information.